To Open Minds Radio. This is your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I have with me the super duper. I think I've used super duper before. Jason McClellan.
Yeah, you've got to keep a list of all of these different.
I know.
Yeah.
I should make a list of new stuff, too, but super duper's kind of cool.
Let's go with super duper. I like it. And hello, Alejandro. How are you today?
Hello. Good.
Excellent. Well, I too am well, and I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, you had kind of a cool weekend thing that you did. A vegan beer and, like, food thing?
Yeah, I went out to L.A. and did that and met up with a couple of our friends out there, and we talked some UFOs and some interesting conversations. But, yeah, it was a good weekend full of vegan food and vegan beer.
Mm-hmm. People don't realize, I think, that you and I are vegetarians,
yep.
You're mostly vegan, and
mm-hmm.
Because we're enlightened beings.
Yeah, they don't eat animals on my planet.
Yeah, mine either.
Yeah.
We're nice, peaceful folk on our planet.
Yeah.
But some just don't agree that all aliens are nice and peaceful, and so be it, huh?
No, some certainly like their meat, and they like their meat particularly human-y.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, some of those human-eating aliens.
Yeah, they're bad.
Yeah, I don't want to come across one of those.
So our guest today is Jeremy Meador, and he talks about, unfortunately, the aliens who have crash-landed on the planet. Actually, it's really interesting because I haven't really heard a lot about this gentleman, and he's young. He's like a college kid. He's 24, but he lives in Las Vegas, and he heard about these potential UFO crashes in an area called Eli and another area called Elko. And so he started investigating them, and turns out he's spoken to, so he says, a lot of witnesses and people who actually knew some of the people who saw this stuff happen. So really, really interesting stuff, especially because, of course, crashes are kind of far and few between, and especially ones that have been well-researched with a lot of witnesses. So, really interesting. So, we'll be talking to him in just a bit. However, first, as usual, Jason and I like to talk about the best news from the week. And this was kind of a big news week, really.
Yeah, some pretty sensational stories. Lots of buzzworthy news, I guess, in the last week.
Mm-hmm. So, I do not know which story you're going to choose. I think I do, but I'm not sure, so I'm excited to hear which story.
Well, you know me well, and I'm sure you have me pegged on this one, but I'm going to talk about the president of the World Chess Federation.
Oh, I didn't realize that one.
Okay.
That's a fun one.
Well, and why are we talking about chess? Well, some of you most likely remember that probably about 4 years ago now is the last time we talked about this guy. And really the real reason I'm talking about this story is because I love saying his name. This is Kirsan Ilyumzhinov. He is the longstanding president of the World Chess Federation. The guy's been leading the organization for 18 years now. And so back in 2010, we talked about him because that's the last time that he was elected to this position. And when these elections come up, he's in the news because this guy has been very outspoken about extraterrestrials, and not only his belief in UFOs and extraterrestrials, but he has made many assertions that he's been visited by extraterrestrials many times and taken aboard their ship and taken into space. So he's been talking about this for more than a decade, probably about 15 years as far as I know, been very, very public with his experiences, and his current in this current election, the main contender is using that against him, saying that he feels that Ilyamzinov's public comments about extraterrestrials are damaging the Chess Federation. He feels that it creates problems in getting sponsors and things like that. But Ilyamzinov has come out and said, I don't know where this guy's getting it. We have sponsors on board. And hey, look, you know, I've been leading this organization for 18 years and things seem to be going all right. So,
yeah.
It's interesting. The election comes up. We'll find out in August if he's going to continue again. But this is a politician. We've seen politicians before who are outspoken about extraterrestrial belief and extraterrestrial contact. I mean, this guy was actually the president of a Russian federation, the Republic of Kalmykia. So he's an actual politician. And it reminds me of the guy in England, the English politician, who you know, has gone on record talking about how his mother is a 9-foot-tall green alien, and he's had many experiences throughout his life. So, you know, politicians talking about this thing, and a lot of the constituents in the places where these people are running for election or currently serving don't seem to make a big deal out of it, which is surprising.
Yeah, especially – that's why – yeah, I'm glad that he popped up again. I guess I'm not too surprised. Maybe I'm more surprised it's taken so long because people love covering this kind of thing. But it's kind of cool that, you know, after coming out about all of this stuff, he was able to remain – in charge of the World Chess Federation.
Especially
and,
with his claims that chess was basically a gift to us from extraterrestrials.
Right.
Yeah.
And when he came out with this stuff, he was president of Kalmykia,
yeah.
Right? And
yeah, that's right.
He didn't get booted out of that either. I mean, he remained president for a while there too. So, yeah, it's really interesting. This guy is so outspoken about these things, and he's still an important person in these organizations.
I've loved every time he's been in a story and we've talked about it, not only because his name is fun to say, but it is an interesting story, and I would love the opportunity to interview this guy one day.
Yeah. Well, I know you practiced his name, and I think I've only recently, just because of you, been able to say it.
So, excellent.
Do I get it right? Kirsan Ilyamzinov.
No.
No?
Keep practicing.
Oh, man.
Maybe next time we talk about him, you'll have it right.
Ilyamzinov,
yep.
All right, got it.
Way to go. All right, what is your story, Alejandro?
My story, I think, is going to be China. Even though, you know, I think people got to check out some other cool stuff. UFO hotspot in Norway, Bob Lazar back in the news, Shatner in his book, some other stuff you wrote about. But China this week has been hot news for us, mostly this latest story, which was Kim's from Friday, and it's just UFOs that were seen and crashed. Some object crashed into a man's garden. It turned out to be space debris, and of course that's what people thought it was in the first place, but this space debris specifically is from a Russian rocket, which exploded in the atmosphere, but it was launched from Kazakhstan, and the Russian officials said that it should have burned up in the atmosphere and nothing should have landed, but it did land in this guy's garden. It looks like it's a tank of some sort that holds liquid for these rockets, but kind of a weird-looking object.
Yeah, and I think that's what led to a lot of the alien speculation or the mystery really behind these objects, because it does look so alien.
Yeah, that
these jagged edges and pretty interesting looking.
That and news from earlier in the week where there's a lot of people, because China has a very big UFO interest, and they've got some big organizations and even some state-sponsored organizations, and we wrote about that earlier in the week because there were some out there suspecting that their moon rover had been damaged or destroyed by aliens or UFOs or something like that. There's no evidence for anything like that, but just like here, there's that sort of speculation that goes on. But they do talk a lot about UFOs out there, and it's a popular topic, and I think that's one of the things that made this story so widely spread as well. But it is, you know, people should look at the pictures because it is kind of this funky-looking device with these ragged edged kind of material around this tank, and it's kind of exciting, kind of fun.
There are also people who are happy to spread the speculation that a UFO shot the rocket down.
Yeah. Oh, right. There is that speculation, because in the video, in one of the scenes, you can kind of see this little dot moving from the right to the left, but I think that's a star. Like you say, it could be practically anything.
There are so many possibilities for what it could be. I mean, for people to jump on that and think it's something out of the ordinary seems to be a big leap to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and but I think one of the bigger concerns here and why Russia was trying to say, oh, no, that's not from our rocket, is because, you know, this thing landed in a garden, luckily, but if that would have landed on a person or a home or something, that's really scary to think of. And the other scary part is that their rocket is exploding at all because we send our astronauts up there with their rockets. So,
yeah,
a lot of
fortunately, that's not happening much anymore.
It's going to slow down.
Lots of issues there, too.
Yeah.
But thank you to our homegrown companies here being more dependent on SpaceX and other companies developing our own rockets.
Yeah. What this reminds me of, this whole episode, though, is in all of this, you know, trouble we're having with Russia and, you know, their influence on Crimea and all of that is 2010. Remember the movie where, you know, the Russians and the Americans were in space together and then there was a war that broke out on Earth between them? I think it even was a nuclear war, right? But their concerns, and of course, I think the main character made love to one of the Russian women as kind of, I guess, a sign of peace between them in space. But it reminds me of that movie.
Yeah.
So
acting out in real life.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Tate's art.
Yeah, pretty fun. All right, so thank you, Mr. Jason, for the news.
Always my pleasure, my friend.
And, of course, people can go to the website to hear more news, see more news, and Spacing Out is done on a weekly basis now where they can go watch a video with some you and Maureen talking about all the news stories.
That is correct.
All at openminds.tv.
What was that site again?
Openminds.tv.
One more time.
I'm glad you asked. It's openminds.tv.
That sounds like a fantastic site. I'm going to check out openminds.tv right now.
Do it. And also, stay tuned for our interview. So let's talk to Jeremy about these really interesting cases in Nevada. I am very happy to welcome to the show Jeremy Meador. Hello, how are you?
I'm doing good.
Great. So it's good to talk to you. I'm really excited to hear more about your research and these UFO crashes and everything in Nevada. But how did you get involved with UFOs in the first place?
Well, I grew up in Las Vegas. And growing up here, you hear all kinds of stories about Area 51, and you hear about Rachel, and of course, the Phoenix Lights were sighted around here. But I'm actually part of the paranormal team here in Las Vegas, where we do take reports on all sorts of UFO phenomenon and do ghost hunts and all that. But one day we decided to go up to Tickaboo Peak and go look at Area 51. And while we were up there, we saw some kind of strange lights in the sky. I know that they were most likely man-made UFOs, but that actually made me want to start looking into the Nevada UFO crashes.
So you had already heard about potential UFO crashes out there?
I had read about UFO crashes on the internet in Las Vegas and over in northern Nevada, but I never really looked into them that much.
Mm-hmm.
And once we started actually talking to people that had seen strange objects, and once we actually saw one ourselves, it made me want to start digging into things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I originally got the information about where to start looking for the Ely, Nevada UFO crash.
Mm-hmm. So it looks like you're also a Bigfoot researcher?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there's a connection?
Funny story. Back in 2008, to make a long story short, we actually did see something that we thought was a Bigfoot over by Lake Tahoe. And on our way out of the area, once we were done investigating, I'd say about an hour or 30 minutes after we saw this creature, we saw some kind of a purple and yellow glowing, like a disc floating above this canyon. Because the road wrapped around the side of this canyon, and down in this valley, you could see this object, like I was saying, with the glowing lights that was just sitting there, blinking. I don't know what it was doing there, but I think it's a great possibility.
Uh-huh. What is your take, I guess, before we move on more into UFOs, just curious, what is your take on the Bigfoot phenomenon? I mean, it sounds like I'm sure you think it's real, but do you feel that they could be extraterrestrial?
I think personally it's more likely to be a type of unknown animal.
Uh-huh.
But I think the UFO possibility would be my second most likely culprit, because I don't understand how all these people are looking for this creature all around the world and almost nobody ends up finding it when they go look for it.
Right.
People usually have these Bigfoot encounters by accident, whether they're driving or they live in a remote area and this animal or whatever you want to call it comes around their home. I think that it's most likely probably an animal, but I do think that if you're saying the UFO is a good possibility.
Uh-huh. So when you decided to start to look into this Eli UFO crash, where did you start?
Well, if you look up the Eli UFO crash, the first thing that comes up is it's a KOLV or KOLO, one of the two. I don't have the exact abbreviation, but there's a news channel over in Reno that did a news story on it. It was like a 5-10 minute segment, and Ed Pierce was the reporter, and he interviewed three different witnesses to a 1952 UFO crash. And I contacted Ed, and I ended up interviewing the witnesses that he spoke with, and I kind of reached a dead end. Well, from there, I ended up contacting the authors of a book called Weird Nevada, and Tim Crenlin was the main author who wrote that one, and he told me that Willard McIntyre of the defunct UFO group Marson was the one that actually originally investigated the case and publicized it in the 1970s. And I ended up contacting Willard, and he pointed me in the right direction on some dates to go look for, and he actually told me that there was a second UFO crash over near Elko, Nevada, in the same year. But we could get into that a little bit later if you want.
Mm-hmm. So what was the gist of the story? What did people believe happened there?
Well, in August of 1952, some kind of an object crashed into a copper mine, which is right outside of Ely, Nevada. It's called the mining town of Ruth. Well, Ruth it's a company-owned town that the miners that worked at the mine, they got free rent or discounted rent from this mine. But anyways, they were working a graveyard shift, and some kind of a glowing object came from the sky and crashed into a snowbank on the... I'm trying to think aside, the eastern side of the mine facing towards Utah. And the government, in relation to this, ended up building a tracking station overlooking this mountain where this UFO had crashed, because they thought that if one UFO crash had happened there, that the second one would crash there.
And that was completed
in 1956, and they also used it as part of Project High Range.
Oh, really? And where did you read this information?
Well, I talked to Ed Pierce, and I talked to several people that lived in the area and
uh-huh.
some workers that worked at the either at the mine or at the Project High Range base. Because there was three bases. There was one in Beatty, Nevada. There was one on Kimberly Mountain overlooking Copper Flats, which is where that UFO crashed. And then there was another one in California, Edwards Air Force Base. And what these bases were is they would track UFO activity, and they would also track the X-15 rocket plane and the effects of high altitude flying on humans.
And you were able to find people who worked at these tracking stations?
Yes, at least I haven't looked for the Edwards Air Force Base one, but I've talked to people that worked at the other two in Nevada, though.
Mm-hmm. And they told you that they were tracking UFOs?
Yeah, one guy in particular, he told me that I guess what happened was the military originally contracted a company to build these bases, and what happened was NASA, them and the United States Air Force ran these bases together, and throughout the years, I guess NASA would either fall out and the Air Force would run them, or when both of them would fall out, they'd have a contracted company run them, but I guess I talked to most of the people I talked to, they worked under contractors or for NASA, which is kind of a weird connection there.
Mm-hmm. And they confirmed to you, they're the ones who told you that these tracking stations were set up, or at least this one over Eli, because of the UFO crash.
Yeah, and actually the man told me that I could actually go up to the site and visit it myself. Of course, it's abandoned nowadays, but I did go up there, and there's a story about that. I went up to the base with my brother and my best friend when one of my earlier trips to Ely to interview witnesses and things. And this base, of course, like I was saying, was abandoned. There's a dirt road that's never been paved. And while you're driving up this dirt road, there's all kinds of pieces of metal, and you could see where the old guard stations were. There's signs saying, warning, you could be shot for going up on top of this mountain from the 1950s.
Wow.
So it was pretty high security at the time. But once we got to the top of this mountain where the base was, there was, I'd say, about two or three old military trailers with radar dishes on the top that they used to track the UFOs and all that. But also there was like a, I guess you could call it a, kind of like a medium-sized regular square building with a fence around it. But anyway, so next to this building, one of these trailers had, I guess, the door was left open by whoever. And my friend Nick, who helps me do a lot of this research, he actually cracked open the door a little bit. And when you looked inside, there was about six different old Mac computers that kind of have, like, the black screen with the green letters on it. And they were running some kind of codes by themselves, and there's nobody in this room. Like, I don't really have an explanation for that, but that's probably the coolest thing that we saw there.
Hmm.
But when we went down the mountain, we were contacted by a man that lives in Ely, and he told us that there's actually three more of those bases that are modern bases that they built in the 1990s, where I guess they picked up where that project left off.
Interesting. So, that's kind of, had you heard about this Project High Range prior to this?
I had heard of Project High Range, but I didn't know that they had a UFO connection.
Mm-hmm.
Because Project High Range was pretty classified until I think it was the 80s. But what happened was they needed a corridor to test the rocket plane. And they would take off from Edwards Air Force Base and fly up to northern Nevada and up near Hill Air Force Base because of the remote area. And they had these radar stations high up on the mountains overlooking these vast distances. And it was almost a perfect scenario for looking for UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
It's a perfect location.
Were you able to talk to some witnesses who actually saw the crash?
The 1952 crash at Ely?
Yes.
Is that the one you were talking about? Yeah. I actually did manage to talk to some of those people, mostly miners. Well, what happened was the disc, I guess it was just like your common silver-colored UFO, but this thing, when it crashed into the snowbank, it was almost undamaged, is what all the miners were saying. And what had happened was, within a few hours of it crashing, the military came, they closed off the roads leading into the mine, and what they did was they took some flatbed trucks, and they put this object on one of these trucks, and they hauled it off the backside of the mine, because there was news media at the front side of the mine, which is the main entrance. And they took this UFO out the backside of the mine, and a lot of the Native Americans on the Duckwater Indian Reservation, they reported seeing this object on the truck being driven through town. I guess the object, some people said that the object was still glowing almost, had like a weird hue to it.
Hmm. So did this object, it crashed like right at the entrance of the mine, or I mean just near the entrance?
Well, the Robinson Copper Mine, it actually had three different mining pits.
Mm-hmm.
And it crashed on the mining pit that's kind of, it's close to the town. The best way to explain is the town is on literally on the side of the mine. Like the high wall, which is like the tallest point in the mine, that overlooks the town. And this UFO crashed close to the high wall, which is, if it crashed any higher, the people in the town would have actually been able to see this thing stuck on the side of the mountain.
Mm-hmm. So, and then, and it was originally found, if I what I was reading, by a train, because it had ruined the train tracks. It, like, I guess, bounced on the train tracks or something?
Oh, that was that's a different case from 10 years later.
Oh, it is. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, in the same area?
Oh, yeah, because what happened was, I originally was looking for the one incident. It turned out that there was three major UFO crashes, at least that I'm aware of. The story usually gets mixed up. There was a 1952 UFO crash in Ely. Then there was a 1964 crash, which was closer to a town called Cherry Creek, which is about 30 minutes to an hour north of Ely.
Mm-hmm. And was that also near another copper mine?
Well, what it was is, the short version of the story is, the Nevada Northern Railway, they used to haul copper out of this copper mine, the Robinson mine I was just telling you about, and they would haul ore out of this mine up to the north where the smelters were. There was one in the town of McGill, which is the next town up from Ely, and then if they go up to an area called Shafter, it would turn into the Southern Pacific, if I'm not mistaken, the Southern Pacific Railroad, and then they would haul it out to Salt Lake City or wherever from there. Well, one day, one of these mining trains was carrying a load of ore, and I guess from what the man told me, I'm going to talk about one guy's specific story, and then I'll get into others in a minute.
Okay.
This guy said he rounded a corner on the train. He was the brakeman, specifically. When they rounded this corner, he said that they could see trouble was up ahead, that the tracks were shredded, and his exact words were that they were bent like pretzels, and that they were thrown 50 to 100 feet, like, all over the place. And he said that he slammed down the brakes on this train, and the train couldn't even stop in time. It partially derailed. And when the train finally came to a halt, and the wheels were smoking and everything, he said that you could see off to the side where the tracks were broken, where an object had came, where I guess the UFO had hit the tracks, bounced off, and landed into the woods nearby.
Wow.
And he told me that at the time, they had no way of, I guess, getting off the train quickly and getting help. So while they were waiting for help, he said that a group of female ranchers, I guess there was at least two, but probably three, he said that they went up to this UFO and they were picked up some pieces off the ground, and I guess they literally were standing on the side of this thing. And I thought it sounded a little far-fetched at first, but I actually managed to talk to one of the ladies nowadays.
Mm-hmm. And she confirmed this?
Yeah. So what happened was, that was one of the train workers' stories. I guess I was on the Coast to Coast AM show, or not Coast to Coast, Art Bell's Dark Matter, his new one on Sirius Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And after the show, I was contacted by a man who said that his mom was one of the ranchers that I mentioned in the story because he was listening. And from what the woman said, and the man confirmed this too, the object was green, like up close it was green. And they said that the pieces that she picked up looked like glass, but they were green, and you could see through them. Not quite like stained glass, but just, I guess, regular glass of a slight green tint. And the woman still has the pieces of the object. But when I asked him to do an interview, the lady, I guess she didn't feel comfortable with me interviewing her beyond that. So I talked to her a couple times on the phone, but nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
But they closed off the highway, what's this, the 80, the 87, 89, they closed off the main highway up there, the freeway, after this object had crashed. And I have a number of reports from motorists who drove up to these barricades of the where the military is making them turn around and all that. But anyways, going forward, when the military showed up, when they finally pulled up to the site and the site was secured and all the civilians are out of the way, what happened was, I guess, the man that was in charge, this, from what I've been told, it's the 9th National Guard unit of Nevada. They had an armory in Ely. But anyway, so when the 9th National Guard pulled up to the site, I guess that there was some kind of a hole ripped in the side of this UFO from where it scraped against the ground or something. And the man said he stood and the general, I don't know what his name is, because the military men don't want to tell me who he is, I guess, because they don't want me tracking him or something. But when the general or whoever was in charge walked inside this spaceship, he said that it looked like you were standing on the desert floor.
Hmm.
Like, you couldn't even tell that you were inside an object. The only way that he could tell he was in an object was because you could see the green hue around him, and then there's a couple of bodies sitting in there, too.
So it was kind of a see-through object from inside?
From inside, you could see out, but uh-huh. When you're on the outside, you couldn't see in.
Uh-huh. What was the shape of the object? Did he describe that to you?
I'm not exactly sure, but from what it sounds like, it's either cigar-shaped or like a cylinder.
Uh-huh.
And mm-hmm. The best part about it, well, not the best part, but what I think is the most interesting part, was when they were in the craft, there was 3 dead bodies, but they said that you could see footprints going off into the woods nearby, like at least one creature got away and went out into the woods. And they started a search, I don't know what you call it, a search operation,
mm-hmm.
And they had the local sheriff and the police, and they had the military looking for these creatures. They don't know how many of them there were, but from what I was told, they captured at least one of these creatures, and they brought it to the local Ely jail, because that's the only place where it had a cage-like environment where they could keep it until some of the right people, whoever was in charge, could pick it up.
What did they describe it looked like?
They said that they were small, 3 to 4 feet tall. They were olive or dark colored. They had large eyes with no noticeable eyelids, ears, or nose. And they didn't make any noise.
Hmm.
But once I heard these reports, I went over to the Nevada Northern Railway Museum in Ely, and I tried looking up information on this train crash. Or not train crash, the train derailing. What I found was interesting. I found a single page. It was in a file box that was called, it said repairs on it. There was a file for the man's name was blacked out, whoever wrote it, and it said that there was 36 or 32 feet of track that was damaged beyond repair, and that they had to send a crew out to repair it. And what else was weird about the whole thing is they have records of the train leaving the mine with the ore, but there's no records of the train arriving anywhere else.
Hmm.
Like the military or whoever had to take the train apart and moved it, or if they brought it back to a train station, for some reason they didn't make any kind of notes on its return.
Mm-hmm.
And Sean Pitts, he's big historian here in Nevada, and he's also the curator of the museum. He told me that he's never read anything like that at all out of however many years he's been there.
Hmm.
And he said that he's heard of sections of track damage, but never that many, never that much.
So you found there's these large sections of track damage, and there was no accounting for what had happened to the train.
Yeah, there was no account on where the train where it arrived. There was no account on why the tracks were damaged. It did say that a train derailed at the edge of the tracks, though.
Mm-hmm. Weird. So what did the so then what did he say about the craft when was it taken away? I mean, the guy with the train that you had been talking about. How did that all end for him? Did they tell him to go away, or?
Well, what happened was the brakeman. He told me that what happened was while they were on the train, the military showed up with some flatbed trucks and some, I don't call them, jeeps.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was they ordered everybody off the train and they took them to the police station in Ely and they interrogated them. But he told me that they had the largest crane in the county at the time. That's what they used to pick up this UFO. Because
mm-hmm.
the UFO was tipped upside down, I forgot to mention, over in the trees. And the biggest crane in the county, it's actually a rail crane. It's they used it for the mine, and it's on the train tracks itself. So what I suspect happened was they would have had to have brought this rail crane down the track, would have had to have used the crane to pick up the train and move it somewhere. And then after they moved the train, they would have had to have taken this crane down the way and used that to pick up the UFO and put it on the truck.
Mm-hmm.
And like I mentioned earlier, there was at least two blockades that the military police set up to keep the civilians out. And I actually did go to the crash site, it was 2010,
mm-hmm.
I think it was 2010, yeah.
And did you see anything interesting?
Oh, yeah. Well, the best way to start about explaining this was that from what I was told, we were supposed to look for an area that was at the base of a mountain that had trees. It used to have a creek running by it in 1964, and it was close to some ranching, like a ranching community. Well, if you go down the highway, off to your right where the Duck Creek Wildlife area is, Duck Creek Wildlife area, you could see from the tracks going diagonally there was a giant, like a crater in the side of this mountain, not in the side, but at the base of this mountain. But it wasn't a crater that was dug straight down or straight, like, horizontally into the mountain. It was at an angle, like something, if you follow the brakeman's story, it could have hit the tracks and bounced off and hit that section of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And there was trees nearby, and there was a creek running in the area at the time. And there's several giant ranches over. I think there's 9 of them nowadays, and there used to be 12.
Hmm.
So it matched the story.
So and you have pictures. It looks like you have a picture next to this kind of crater on your website, EliUFOCrash.webs.com. Is that what I'm looking at, where you're standing?
Yeah, that's my friend Nick standing in the crater. I was actually the one taking the picture.
Gotcha.
And what's weird about this crater is there's grass and there's trees. I don't know if they're not necessarily pine trees. I'm not smart with that sort of thing. But there's trees. It's like a forest environment. And in the middle of this forest environment, there's a random giant hole in the side of the mountain.
Hmm.
And there's nothing growing inside this hole. Like I've heard stories about when UFOs crash or if they land in an area that usually things, vegetation won't grow in that area.
Yeah, it is interesting because you can see in this picture that the mountain has, you know, typical brush. It looks like it might be pinons or something, but where you're standing or where your friend's standing and in this crater area, it's just completely barren, nothing.
And you can actually see that on MapQuest. I don't have Google Earth, but on MapQuest, if you go to the satellite view and you go over towards the entrance to the Duck Creek Wildlife Area, you could actually see it from the sky. That's how big this crater is.
That is pretty strange. Now, in 1950... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, if you use MapQuest as kind of like a something to work off of, if you could actually have a route of where the original Nevada Northern Railway tracks are at nowadays, and you could actually see the comparison of what I was talking about if you have it on the specific view.
Mm-hmm. So in 1952 and that incident, what did that craft look like?
That craft was also just like kind of like a disc. That one wasn't cylindrical. From what I was told, it was a smaller craft, and I guess they said it was like a 2 to 3 human beings could have fit inside of it. So it wasn't very big. But that one wasn't really that damaged. The one in 1964 had a giant hole ripped in the side.
Yeah. And how big was the one in 1964 then, the cylinder one? Was that a very, I mean, because this impact site, if that's what it is, looks very large.
Well, they said it took the biggest crane in the county to pick it up, but at the same time, the guy said it took 2 trucks to fit the UFO on. And I guess they had to kind of, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for. They had to kind of work together, driving at the same speed and all that, to make it work, to drive it to wherever they took it.
Yeah, pretty weird, pretty interesting. So it sounds like you've talked to a lot of witnesses.
And supposedly,
sounds like you've talked to a lot of witnesses. So in the 1952 incident, how many witnesses have you talked to then?
There's about 40 from 1952, whether they're civilians, military, or people that worked for different newspapers and things that reported on it at the time.
Really? And you talked to all of these people?
Yeah, I talked to about 40 from 1952. The 1960 thing I didn't find out until fairly recently, so there's only about 12 or 15 of them. I actually have the most witnesses from something that happened near Elko in December of 1952.
Yeah, what happened
the
there?
The something I was going to mention was I told you one of the aliens was captured.
Yeah.
There was another one in 1979. There was an article in the Ely Times newspaper that said that there was a hunter that supposedly found bones of what he thought was an alien. And I think it was November 8th of 1979 in the Ely Times newspaper. I had the article saved to a flash drive. I was going to put it in my book. I haven't really had a chance to work on that yet. But there's no explanation of what ended up happening with the man or the bones.
Do you think that was...
I think that they used an alias of some sort.
But
I'm not quite sure because I haven't looked into it that much yet. But
do you think what he found was one of the bodies of something that... survived in 1964?
I think so, because if you talk to the ranchers in the area over by Cherry Creek, they all know the story, and they actually know who it was. They don't really say who it was, but I mean, they'll tell you that they know the story. Because they kind of, it's a small town environment. Ely's only about 4,000 people today, and all the other towns are smaller than Ely. So they kind of protect each other and they look out for each other. So if one person in the community doesn't want anything to be known, usually the other people will respect that and they don't really talk about it.
Gotcha. So this is all pretty interesting. I mean, that's a lot of witnesses for each of these incidents. So I'd imagine that you feel pretty strongly that both of these things really occurred.
Yes, and I was contacted by Hill Air Force Base on two occasions about this, and then I also had a run-in with what I think was the Men in Black back in 2008.
Yeah, what happened? What did that? I guess first with Hill Air Force, what did they want to talk to you about?
Well, when I first started out, I contacted the Nevada MUFON, and I talked to Stanton Friedman and a couple other people. And I don't know how they found out, but I received a call on my cell phone one day right before I was getting ready to leave for college, and there was a man who said that he was a historian from Hill Air Force Base, and they said that he was doing a story on plane crashes. And I asked him if I could ask him about a crash that I was working on. I didn't tell him it was UFOs at the time. But he said, sure. I'm pretty sure he already knew what I was going to say before I said it. And I asked him, I was like, okay, well, I'm looking up a crash that happened in 1952 near Ely, Nevada. And he says, when? And I said, oh, 1952 near Ely. And he says, oh, those types of crashes are classified. And then he started asking me information about my college professors and what my major was and things like that. Well, at the time, I didn't know what he was talking about or why he was asking me that. So he kind of just hung up the phone, and I thought, okay, well, I just talked to this guy from the military, and he didn't say that it didn't happen, but he didn't say that it did. So about 2 months later, I was getting ready to head up to Ely to interview a civilian, a lady that lived in East Ely at the time, who saw the object fly over her house right before it crashed. And I was supposed to go talk to this lady over the weekend on, I think it was like a Thursday or a Friday, something like that. And she called me on about the middle of the week, I'd say, like Tuesday or Wednesday. And she told me that she thanked me for doing the interview with her. And she said that me and my friend Nick showed up at her house, and she starts describing this interview. Well, it wasn't me and my friend Nick, because we were in Las Vegas, and she's like 4 hours north in Ely. And she started describing the interview, and these two men pulled up in a van with blacked-out windows, and they started talking about my private life and my friend Nick's private life. They were talking about my college professors and all the information I gave that historian, the people that interviewed that lady were talking about. So I'm pretty sure that man, for some reason, got my information so that somebody here could impersonate me in whatever, for whatever reason. I don't really know what to think about that.
Yeah, that's awfully weird. So how did you, I'm sure you told her that that wasn't you she talked to. Was she pretty freaked out by that?
She actually got so freaked out and so scared that she never talked to us again. So I haven't had a chance to really ask her much about it.
Mm-hmm.
But she only talked to me about it for about 10 or 15 minutes after I said that wasn't me and it wasn't my friend.
Wow, that's kind of freaky. So then,
yeah,
was this 1964, that sounds like this is the latest crash that you've been investigating, so, but there is another one you mentioned in Elko. When did you find out about that one, and where did that one, or when did that one take place?
Well, I originally found out about the Elko crash. It's in 1952 in December. I actually found out that one from Willard McIntyre. He told me that he had two crash dates for Ely, and that one of them was from Ely and one of them was from somewhere else, but he wasn't sure where.
Hmm.
And when I started looking into it, Project Blue Book actually had multiple accounts and multiple papers from newspapers documenting a UFO crash near Elko. And what happened there was at around 10:30 in the morning, a black object was seen flying over Salt Lake City, and it was on fire, leaving a blue gaseous cloud behind it. And tons of people in Salt Lake City and Ogden seen this thing. And there was a bomber. It was a B-26. Well, anyway, there was a B-26 that was flying over Salt Lake City doing a training mission. That was piloted by Major Cal White. Major Cal White was told to go chase after this UFO, and they were flying 300 miles per hour, and they couldn't catch up to this thing. And I know that's not very fast for modern-day airplanes, but at the time, that was pretty booking it.
Mm-hmm.
So when they were chasing after this object, when they would fly into this gaseous cloud, it's almost like their plane started malfunctioning, they would start losing altitude, and pretty scary stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, eventually, they caught up with the object because the object just stopped suddenly and was standing still. When the airplane got close to it, this object went 90 degrees down towards the Earth and then shot out horizontally towards Nevada. And this object shot down so quickly, they thought that the object had crashed into the Salt Lake. And the military originally sent out a search force to go look in Salt Lake. Well, The next part of the story is reported in the Ogden Standard Examiner, and it comes from a man named Ralph Gibbs. He's a soil conservationist from Nevada at the time near Montello. He said that him and some of the other people near in this small railroad town, they heard an explosion, and they went out on the flatlands in the Derry Valley to go see what it was, and down in the valley they could see a giant blackened, burnt patch of land, and the military was picking up this UFO. Well, there was another guy who was a train master. His last name was Hobbs, H-O-B-B-S. Hobbes said that when this object crashed in the ground near Montello, that the ground shook and that you could see this gaseous blue cloud rising in the sky. So that's just the beginning of the story, because the story gets much stranger. Mm-hmm. That was around 10:30 in the morning, 10:32 to be exact. At 11:40 or so, there was a small airplane carrying people to Boise, Idaho. And they said that near the Pilot Creek, which is over by Wendover, Nevada, they saw there's a giant brush fire raging down below. And they reported this into the air traffic control towers, and they told the military that a plane had crashed, and they went out to investigate. Well, doing further investigating and talking to witnesses over in Salt Lake City, when the object was first reported to be on fire, and when this object was on fire and it's being chased by the jet, they thought they'd seen a flash of lightning, and it's even reported in Major Calvart's documentation on Project Blue Book. They saw this flash of lightning, and what actually happened was a second UFO came from the Idaho area, collided with the first one I was telling you about over Salt Lake City, and they both crashed. One crashed an hour later to the south, and the other one crashed near Elko. So it's kind of hard to follow.
Mm-hmm. So what do you know about like what this one looked like and its characteristics?
Well, there were two of them that hit each other. One of them was green and was P-shaped, and it was a smaller, about the size of a Volkswagen car. That's the one that crashed to the south. The one that crashed to the north was very large, the one that was being chased by the jet, and that one was black and it was square, and it had no windows on it. And that object was the one that had the giant explosion and the ground shook. The other one, there wasn't even an explosion reported, so that's how small that one was. But the first ones on the scene to this, I think it's the northern side, there were volunteer firefighters arrived on the scene, and they were telling me that when they pulled up on the scene, they thought that some kind of a plane had crashed, so they got their fire equipment ready, and they were going towards this where this fire was. And he said that it was unusual from the beginning, because he said you could smell almost like a chemical smell in the air. And as they were getting closer to this pit, or they thought that the plane had hit the ground, but they noticed that there was like a pit going down in the ground, which was unusual. And the closer they got, this chemical smell started getting stronger, and they were coughing, and their noses were running uncontrollably. And I guess when they got to the edge of the pit, they saw that this object was embedded in the ground and it was smoking and smoldering, like it was very hot. And he said they didn't know what to do because they had never seen anything like this. They'd never heard of anything like that. And I guess while they were starting to try to put out this fire, the military had showed up and told them all to leave, and they ended up interrogating these people. But other than that, there's not really very much documentation of the crash sites besides the Ralph Gibbs sighting and a couple of the railroad workers. And to the south, I have really not much documentation beyond what the newspapers reported. The Salt Lake Tribune, the Ogden Standard Examiner, the Ely Times. So I'm still working on that one, but that's pretty... That's the gist of that one.
Mm-hmm. So at some point, also, it looks like you had come across some materials, possibly from these incidents.
Yeah, well, the materials I was given either came from the incident at Ely I was telling you about, the one that crashed in the copper mine. Mm-hmm. Or it came from another incident that happened in 1974 over in the same copper mine I was telling you, in the Robinson mine. There was an object during the night shift that had landed, this is the short version, a glowing object landed in this copper mine in the middle of the night. And whatever this object was spraying a red liquid all over the ground as this thing was landing. and this thing just kind of settled on the ground, and within minutes, they were saying, the military showed up. And the workers were telling me that shortly before the object landed, the foreman or whoever was in charge of the mine was telling everybody that they needed to leave and that they needed to leave immediately. And as people were clearing out, they were getting more demanding and were raising their voice and yelling, almost as if they knew this thing was coming. And when this thing landed in the mine, I have different perspectives from welders, haulers, different types of people driving in and out of the mine who reported this object. Well, anyway, so I was telling you it was spraying this liquid out. The military picked up the UFO with helicopters, and they flew this thing over Ely in the middle of the daytime a week later. And that in itself, I don't understand, but they picked it up with some helicopters and flew it over Ely in the daytime, and that's one of the most widely witnessed UFO incidents I've ever heard of.
Yeah, weird, of course, because the whole city could see it then.
Yeah, it wasn't even really covered up. It was just,
wow,
just out in the open. Like they.
What shape was that
was
object?
What's that?
What shape was that object?
That one was just like just like your average UFO, where it had two cylindrical discs on top of each other, two saucers. That one, I think, might have been a man-made UFO, like it was one of ours.
Uh-huh.
But it could have come from space, too.
But that's
either way,
the one
they would have had to have been tracking it to arrive there so quickly.
Uh-huh. And that's the one that was spewing this red stuff.
Yeah, so that thing was spewing out this red liquid, and I was given this strange rock. This woman gave me the strange rock, who lived in the town of Ruth, which is the closest town to where this happened. And she told me that she goes on these nature walks every day, and during her nature walk, she stops by these sand piles. These sand piles are out of the ordinary because they didn't come from the mine, because there's no records of the mine putting them there, and none of the locals couldn't know who put them there. But there are these big piles of sand, and laying around these piles of sand, there's the occasional, it's almost like a weird red-grayish rock. And she gave me one of these rocks, and what it was is that red liquid, whatever it was, it hardened and mixed with the gravel that was on the ground and hardened. And nowadays, it's like a type of rock. I have one of these rocks still, and I got it analyzed by several geologists, two professors at the college in Nevada, or in Las Vegas, the UNLV college. Nobody could tell me what it is. They think that the closest thing that is a hematite rock, which is a rock that has some magnetic properties and it's mostly made of iron. Mm-hmm. But since, of course, this was in a mine, it's going to have a lot of iron in it anyways. So the rocks are unexplained. Whatever it is, it's some of whatever that red liquid was. Whether it was hydraulic fluid or a type of oil, I'm not exactly sure.
Mm-hmm. Wow, pretty weird, huh?
Yeah, and I even when I do my speaking lectures, when I go to like conventions and when I do radio shows, like in the studio, I usually bring the rock with me, and everybody thinks it's really cool.
Yeah, and then one of the other rocks you have in these pictures here, I'm assuming that you have a picture with three of the objects, and that rock you're referring to now is the one on the far right. But you have another one that seems to have some sort of metal or some sort of object embedded in it?
Well, yeah, what those are is there's two of the samples are the same. The bigger rock, the big rock, and the biggest one in the picture is the same thing as the one that looks like it has the metal thing coming out of it.
Okay.
But what the object looks like coming out of it, that's actually magnets that are sticking to the rock.
Oh, I see. Okay. Just to show that it's magnetic.
Yeah, and then the yellow thing, that's something else altogether. That came from the 1952 wreck I was telling you about. I don't really know where to start with that, because when this thing was so molten, from what I was told, I don't know, some people say it was hot, some people say it wasn't. So I usually don't talk about that one that much, but some people say that when the object hit the ground, that it kind of fused some of the sand together in like a weird sandstone-like substance. Well, the same lady that gave me the red rock, she actually had a sample of that yellow stuff. And what that is supposedly when the object hit the ground, I told you the sand fused together. But when you pick the object up in person, it feels like you're not holding anything in your hands at all. It's super lightweight. And it has like a honeycomb structure on the inside of it. And if you look on it, you could see where it was bubbling and molten at one time. And I don't have that one. I only have the red rock, but I have pictures of that yellow one like you're looking at. And I took the picture down when I was going to meet some geologists from the Robinson Copper Mine one day at the White Pine Public Museum down in downtown Ely. And the historian there, and the curator of that place, his name's Howard Bourne. Howard told me that he actually had a sample of that yellow stuff that was fused to a piece of wood from a town that was in the area at the time called Ripetown. Well, Ripetown doesn't exist anymore, but before it was torn down, I guess the planks of wooden things that were out of the ordinary people saved. And some of that yellow sand substance is fused around a piece of wood. It's not on display for the public, but they have it in their collections. And so multiple people have the weird yellow substance. I was unable to get that one tested. But he told me from what he knows, because he used to work at the smelter over in the town of McGill, he told me it looks similar to a type of sulfur that they used to use.
Wow, that's pretty strange. So now you've got all of this material and you're trying to put it into, or you're working on putting it into a book?
I'm about 100 pages in right now.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be kind of a short book,
mm-hmm. But
I'm thinking about 150 or 130.
Really? Because this is a lot of information. I feel kind of overwhelmed with all of this information myself.
Yeah.
It seems like it would go into like a 500-page book or something like that.
Yeah, but it's like, since this is my first book I'm writing at the moment, I think I need to go back and talk about a couple other things. But it seems like it's, when I put it down on paper, my thoughts kind of go in a different direction, and it seems like it's,
uh-huh.
I kind of write everything out too soon, and then I don't get a chance to really talk about it as much.
Right. So it looks like this information can be found on your website, EliUFOCrash.webs.com. Is that the best place for people to go to look at this?
I try to update that website, but I haven't been able to a lot lately.
Okay.
I guess the best place to look would be my blog.
Mm-hmm.
It's king-sasquatch-bfpteam.blogspot.com.
Okay.
Or you could just search my name. You just type in Jeremy Metter, Eva UFO Crash, and it should come up on there.
Okay. Yeah, and I'll definitely put the link also when I post the story so people will be able to get that link there. I'll put both of those links up there just so people can see because you have some great pictures at that, Eli. Mm-hmm. UFO site. So really interesting stuff, and you've been pretty busy lately talking about it, right? You talked with Art Bell, and you were also on a sci-fi show.
I was on Sci-Fi Channel, History International. I was on Art Bell's Dark Matter,
mm-hmm.
A couple of other radio shows. I actually am supposed to have my book's going to be released in the end of July or and it's either the end of July or the end of August.
Okay.
Because on August 23rd, I'm supposed to do a lecture at the Las Vegas Paracon over at the Cashman Center here in Las Vegas
cool.
for the release of my book.
Cool, cool. Well, that sounds so really cool.
Oh, yeah, it is. As far as I know, I'm the only UFO-related speaker there, so it should be easy to find me.
Well, this is really, really interesting. I'm fascinated that you have so many witnesses because that's pretty mm-hmm. rare. I mean, of course, we have Roswell and there are a few others, but it's rare to have so many witnesses, and you've talked to a lot of people. So that's really exciting, and I would definitely mm-hmm. like you to keep me up to date because I think your book's something I'd definitely like to take a look at, and I think others would too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. I'd like to come back on your show, or I'll write on your Facebook and let you know, or
okay.
however you want to do it. And
all the above.
So sometimes it's kind of hard to remember some of the names of, like, the train conductors and things. I've talked to a lot of people, so.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you've talked to nearly 100 people.
Yeah, because I started back in the summer of 2008, so it's going on 6 years now.
Wow. Wow, that's a lot. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and telling me about it. It's a lot of great information, so people hopefully will check out your links and read more, and we'll definitely keep in touch so I can let people know when your book comes out.
Oh, definitely. Thanks for having me on the show, Alejandro.
Okay, thank you so much to Jeremy for being on the show. Really interesting stuff. I mean, to have so many witnesses related to a possible UFO crash is pretty extraordinary. So I'm sure we're going to hear more from him. It'll be exciting when he gets his book up. But if you want to hear more, you can go to his website. He does, as he says, has the Eli UFO Crash website, which is just eliufocrash.webs.com, but like you said, he hasn't been able to update that. So the other thing he has is a King Sasquatch site, and the URL is really long and it's got lots of letters and dashes and kind of going to be really hard to remember. But if you just Google King Sasquatch, or if you look up Jeremy Meador, and that is spelled M-E-A-D-O-R, you're going to be able to find his site that way. So go ahead and Google him and check it out, because it's really interesting, especially if you go to the Eli UFO site. You're going to see lots of pictures of the stuff that we talked about, that crater that he found, and then also those rocks that are some kind of mysterious material. So you'll be able to find that all there. All right. Well, don't forget also to check us out on the top social networking apps. We're on Twitter at Open Minds TV. Facebook, we're on there at Open Minds Radio and Open Minds Magazine. You can also find me personally at AstroATR and Jason at AceCentric. And Maureen is simply Maureen Ellsbury. So go check us out there. We're tweeting our news all of the time, and you can find us all on Facebook as well. You can also find all of the stories that we talked about in the news section at openminds.tv, where we update you on the latest UFO news on a daily basis. You can catch our UFO news webcast, Spacing Out, on our YouTube channel, and you can find all of this, of course, at openminds.tv. I also want to thank the artist who created our music, Caleb Hanks. You can find more about his music and download it for free at theclerkchronicles.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back with another great show maybe late in the week next week, because, of course, it's a holiday week, or the week after. But we'll be back soon. Until then, adios, muchachos.